podcast is brought to you by the NATO Association of Canada and the University of Toronto's NATO Research Group.
Hello, my name is Marwan.
And my name is Bianca, and we are here today with Dr. Randall Hansen to discuss the polarized topic of migration and refugees.
Randall Hansen is a political scientist and historian at the University of Toronto, where he holds a Canada Research Chair in Global Migration in the Department of Political Science. He is also director of the Global Migration Lab at the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy. Hansen has taught at the Queen Mary London University and at the University of Oxford before taking up his current position. He also wrote books about migration in Europe, Middle East, and World War II. His area of expertise is about immigration flows and refugee crisis. So, Dr. Randall, could you tell us more about your background and your research about refugees?
Thank you, above all, for having me. I've been working on the topic of immigration for about 25 years, and about half of that has been forced migration, which was always a topic of interest. And since 2015, it's really been one of the defining issues of global European Middle Eastern politics.
So, refugee crisis. It's one of the biggest crises in the world. The UNHCR announced that we had surpassed the 100 million mark for total displacement. Can you imagine that? Meaning that over 1.2% of the global population have been forced to leave their homes. Among these people are over 32.5 million refugees. 76% of those refugees come from just six countries. Refugees leave their country due to wars, civil wars, food insecurity, institutional racism, and climate change. Forced migration, especially in the Southern Hemisphere, where the ability of many states to host asylum seekers and refugees is limited. That feeds the narrative of a global migration crisis that is destabilizing countries and entire regions. Wars and violence in Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, the DRC, Myanmar, and Gaza continue to feed the growth in numbers of forced migrants. Refugees then settle in other countries, which could lead sometimes to long-term economic, social, political, and environmental impacts if institutions don't manage their arrival well. Refugees can sometimes be a burden or an opportunity to countries. Which leads me to the first question. Since refugees are sometimes a burden or opportunities to many countries, can you please provide me with your analysis regarding the fate of the Palestinians of Gaza and what could be the best circumstance for them, given that their homes have been completely destroyed?
Yes, thank you very much. Well, in the case of Gaza, they're not dealt with by the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, but by UNRWA, so it's a slightly separate refugee group. But in practice, many of the same dynamics apply, except that, of course, they're not refugees because they've not crossed a border. And there's really two broad options for coping with this humanitarian disaster: defeating Hamas and ending the war as quickly as possible, and creating structures within Gaza that give the Palestinians with Gaza some prospect for a decent life, and or, in the midterm, opening opportunities for them to leave. But that really comes down to Egypt, and Cairo, for domestic political reasons, is unwilling to allow Palestinians to enter.
On that note, we see that Israel has advocated for migration of refugees in Gaza to go to its Arab neighbors, which include Egypt. Egypt's position on forced migration at the moment is that it's wrong, according to President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. However, in times of war where innocent civilians' lives are being lost, why is it that neighboring countries aren't taking in more refugees that have been displaced from the war?
Well, there's good and bad reasons for Cairo's opposition. The understandable, the good or at least understandable reason, is that they're worried about being able to cope with up to, say, 2 million refugees that would place great strains on what is, at the end of the day, not a wealthy country.
And on top of that as well, Egypt's also in an economic crisis. There's a high unemployment rate. They can't handle that amount of refugees at once. And on the same time, they're also very afraid that if Palestinians are displaced in Sinai, there could be any counterattack on Israel, which is very possible, and that could cause trouble between Egypt and Israel on sovereignty issues as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That was my second point, was the security threats, both domestically in terms of domestic terrorism, which Egypt has suffered to a superlative degree in the past, and, as you rightly point out, attacks on attacks on Israel, which would drag possibly Egypt into a war. The Second reason is that Cairo is worried that if they are pushed out, they won't be let back in, because the history of the creation and the expansion of Israel has been the permanent displacement of Palestinians. So I think they are understandably also worried, perhaps two good reasons, not one good and bad, that the in the second case, that if the Palestinians are pushed out, they won't be let back, and there'll be a land grab on the part of Israel. Now, whether that concern is legitimate or not, it's real.
Yeah.
But Western countries have fully supported Ukraine in times of war, and many countries, including Canada, have welcomed thousands of Ukrainian refugees. Why aren't we seeing the Western world trying to help the Palestinians that are on the borders and who have a high chance of dying as well, like they were to helping Ukraine?
Yeah, I mean, again, the logic for the Palestinians is slightly different from a classic refugee logic. But the technical answer is that they can't be refugees in the classic sense, because they can't cross the border, make it to Europe, make it to Canada.
The definitions are very important.
Absolutely. So they would have to be resettled. And so we have to create a resettlement program where Palestinians are given security clearance and then resettled in Germany, in the States, and Australia, and so on. That's not even on the table, and frankly, probably impossible in the context of Well, I mean, the bombs are landing, so how would you even set up the infrastructure for resettlement? And just adding to that, resettlement numbers are always way too small. So the only way to process Palestinians as refugees, again, they're not dealt with through UNHCR anyway, but hypothetically, would be to open the borders, allow them all to flee, and then to apply for asylum. And as the borders are sealed, it's not going to happen. Resettlement won't happen, and if it did, the numbers would be too small.
Is sending planes and boats a possible solution?
No.
No?
I mean, not even on the agenda.
Yeah.
There's not. The only time you have mass airlifts, say that you... The Ugandan Asians in 1972 taken to the UK is of your own citizens, very rarely. I struggle to think of an example of other country citizens.
Yeah. With the Israel-Hamas war, in your opinion, do you think it'll trigger a new immigration crisis in Europe? And what do you think can be done to mitigate another large-scale migration crisis? Are there steps that the EU, NGOs, or NATO can do?
Yeah, no, I don't think it will, because, as is often said at the moment, the Gazans are in the largest open-air prison. Now, that's usually meant as a criticism of the Israelis, but the prison is also run by Hamas, so the Palestinians simply cannot leave, and if you cannot leave, then you cannot claim asylum. It's much more likely that the political instability in sub-Saharan Africa, that will provoke another refugee crisis, or if the war between Israel and Hamas develops into a broader Middle Eastern conflict.
Mm-hmm.
If Lebanon is destabilized, if Iran gets involved, then we could see mass refugee outflows. Because most forced migrants, you said it already, they flee not classic persecution, but war.
We're going to switch our topic over a little bit more to forced migration. As you've talked a lot about it in your articles, and we've talked a lot about it now with the Gazas and with the Palestinians in Gaza. So over the years, we've seen forced migration at an all-time high due to numerous reasons, which include escaping violence, climate change, wars, as you mentioned, as well as, you know, refugees and asylum seekers. So until the war in Ukraine, 86% of forced migrants, which is almost 70 million people, were hosted in developing countries, particularly in the south, where a lot of resources are limited to host them, you know, financially. So can you explain a little bit to us why developing countries take on a lot of the heavy lifting in forced migration?
Yeah, in all cases, migration, the forced migration, the patterns of forced migration are determined by what's called accidents of geography. So refugees flee until they no longer have to flee. Most of them are internally displaced persons, that's over 60 million, and the others who cross the border go to the nearest countries.
Yeah.
As the most unstable countries are in the global south, most refugees are in the global south. What we saw in the case of Ukraine is a European refugee crisis.
Yeah.
And again, they all fled to contiguous countries, to Poland, to Hungary, to Germany, and moving on.
Okay. So with forced migration, we know that there's a legal conundrum with states that take them in, more in regards to distinguishing between political refugees and economic migrants. Why is it that these two terms hold so much weight in migration discussion? When we think about the liberal paradox in mind, you know, how can liberal states satisfy their humanitarian responsibilities while not undermining their own borders, border security in regard to nationalism and populism? I know that's like a big concern for a lot of countries when taking in refugees. They, you know, I know Hungary thinks a lot about nationalism and populism. So what do you think can be done in those terms?
Yeah, some big questions there. There's a left-wing and right-wing answer to that.
Mm-hmm.
The right wants to conflate those categories, economic migrants and refugees, so they can claim that refugees just want a better life and then have no right of entry.
Mm-hmm.
The left, or part of the left, wants to keep them distinct so that we preserve the international refugee regime, protecting refugees. As a matter of fact, most migration flows are mixed, and it's very hard to separate people. Most people flee war. They flee for their lives.
Yeah.
But when they move on, for example, to Turkey or to Libya, let's say from Syria or from Nigeria on to Libya, they find they can't earn a living there, their lives are still in danger, they have no scope for their family, then they become secondary migrants moving
to
right, so what do you think about, like, what's your opinion on refugees? For what are the policies that should be done for refugees to live like a more stabilized life when they flee their countries?
Yeah, and let's take that in the context of Europe and in the context of populism. Firstly, we have to respect our obligations to refugees, full stop.
Yeah.
There shouldn't be a discussion. Second, however, the degree to which economic migrants use refugee channels flows from the fact that there's no options for them to migrate to Europe. So we need to open migration channels. We need a more positive narrative about migrants and refugees in Europe. Part of the reason the Ukrainians have been welcomed is partly about race and racism, but it's also because the whole official narrative has been so positive. And the left won't like this, we need to secure the borders.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you have an impression that you've lost control of your borders, support for immigration just collapses.
Yeah.
This requires a strong state.
Or effective state, yeah, absolutely.
Cooperation. I know the EU, Angela Merkel. The German Chancellor, she's, you know, been trying to have some sort of policy that unites migration. How effective it is, I'm not sure yet. I guess time will tell.
Well, yeah, I mean, Merkel tried, as has her successor, Scholz.
Yes.
The difficulty is that the Central European countries, for their domestic reasons, playing to the populist right, playing to the racists, won't play ball. But yes, a united EU response is, the need for it is clear.
I remember once reading one of your articles when you said immigration is employment. Or if you want like sustainable immigration in your country, you need to have good employment in your country. Can you please explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I said is that immigration and immigration policy work when immigrants work. And what I meant by that is two things. One, domestic public, especially in Europe where you have generous welfare, will not support immigration if they believe that migrants are migrating to take advantage of the welfare state.
Yeah.
But also, for migrants themselves, access to work, and above all good work, is basic to a decent life for themselves and for their children.
Yeah.
And if migrants are coming to Europe for a better life, and I've done many interviews with migrants, with refugees, they're thinking not about themselves, but about hope for their children.
Yeah.
So good jobs for them, opportunities in the educational system for their kids. That's basic to making migration work.
Yeah. Do you think France has adopted that policy well? Since a lot of Arabs, a lot of Africans, they fly to France for like better lives, obviously, and then the government provides for them good education, free healthcare, all that. Do you think that's a good policy for them?
Well, I mean, France comes under a huge amount of criticism within the migration literature, and they get a lot of things right. I mean, they have a framework of republicanism, which is in principle race-wide, which says that anyone can become French. They have actually relatively high levels of equality within France. They have a generous welfare state. Where France falls down, and not just for migrants, is excessively high youth unemployment and migrant unemployment. So that they're not getting right, and it's too complex to go into a podcast, but part of it, I think that the failures of France are not so much cultural. There's an obsession about the hijab on Islam, debates of secularism.
Institutional racism.
Yeah, I mean, and it's real, but cash matters more than culture, which is to say getting migrants, Arab migrants, to take your example, into work. is the most important. In the absence of opportunities for youth in the suburbs, I think that matters most.
Yeah.
Migrant or non-migrant.
And there's also a lot of financial incentives. I know the EU provides a lot of financial incentives to, you know, for example, Turkey as an incentive to take in more migrants and refugees. So,
That's a border control.
Border control.
But yeah,
even
because
African countries, they do that as well.
Yeah, and that's incredibly morally murky, because when we work with Libya to stop the boats, nominally to keep people from drowning, that's the argument, to stop the smugglers, what we do is we send them back to Libya, where they end up in torture camps. It's hideous. The question is, would it be better or worse without EU involvement? And can the EU, by negotiating those backs, impose conditions, minimum conditions? It's an open question. And secondly, what's the alternative? Because if European countries continue to create the impression that they've lost control of their borders, the far right will rise more and more in power.
Yeah.
And if Le Pen comes to power in France, or the alternative for Germany in Germany, we risk losing everything.
Yeah.
So Europe, above all, existing as this continent of prosperity and democracy above this zone of violence, faces torturous decisions that this country, Canada, or even the States, frankly, does not.
Yeah. Now, let's talk about South Sudan, which the media isn't covering at all these days, sadly. Over 4 million South Sudanese people have been forced from their homes, with 2.3 million of those having to leave the country entirely, and 2.2 million remain internally displaced in South Sudan due to violent conflict throughout the country. 65% of South Sudanese refugees are under the age of 18. That's a crisis. What can the international community do to help the Sudanese people and to improve their living condition? Because Sudanese refugees mostly flee to countries with poor living conditions, such as Ethiopia, Sudan, Djibouti, DRC, etc.
Yeah, and you could take that as an example of the broader crisis of refugees, mainly fleeing war, mainly going to contiguous countries. And it's glib to say that I have solutions, but I guess the first point is the media should be less selective in its obsessions. We're hearing all about Israel and nothing about Sudan, so you rightly call that out. Two, transfer resources to where the refugees are. So Ethiopia actually does quite a good job of supporting refugees, trying to get them into work, providing money to Ethiopia to do so. And the rich countries of the world need to do more. And if they are worried about, really worried about people crossing the Mediterranean, quote-unquote, illegally in an unauthorized manner and dangerously, expand resettlement so you can move people from the first countries of asylum to Europe. And this has been widely said, it's just not being done.
How could they do more?
Well, expanding resettlement would be the first one. And then more resources for the countries that are hosting them, and not merely in a humanitarian way, but more almost linked to development, accepting that, you know, Alex Alinikoff, the former deputy head of UNHCR, says one of the laws of refugees is forced displaced populations remain displaced. So they'll probably end up staying in Ethiopia, provide resources to Ethiopians to educate, to house, to provide them jobs, and also open more channels for them to come to the richest country in the world, North America and Europe.
Yeah.
Just like they did with Ukraine, for example. Like, they haven't done the same with South Sudanese people or Yemenese people.
Yeah, and that's partly right. But again, what the critics of Europe and its hypocritical attitude to refugees ignore is, well, first, the Germans were equally generous with the Syrians, so it wasn't simply other Europeans. But two, it was a classic forced migration movement where you flee to the neighboring countries. Ukraine is in Europe, the refugees are in Europe. Where I think you're right is with the Ukrainians, they didn't make them refugees, but they gave them temporary protection with full rights. So they respected refugee agency. Move where you want, work where you want, end up in the EU where you want, and it's worked brilliantly. When you're a refugee from Syria or from Sudan, you're highly restricted in your rights, where you can live, often sent out to the country where there are no jobs. Those policies if we could treat Middle Eastern refugees, African refugees, as we treated Ukrainians from that perspective, that would be much better for everyone concerned.
Why don't they treat them the same? Because they're undereducated, because they think it's going to cause more trouble in their countries, raise the crime rates. Why aren't they helping? Because especially Sudan, the amount of 65% of the refugees are under the age of 18. They're still kids.
Well, yeah, and then they obviously need a very different framework because they can't be treated as a 30-year
That ties a lot into international law and what international law, you know.
The UNICEF, does it have to do anything to do with it, for example?
Well, I mean, let's break those questions down. Why are Ukrainians treated differently? Well, again, partly they were dealt with a different legal framework, which was first developed for Kosovo, though never deployed. The second is, if racism might be a strong word, but is cultural factors. Ukrainians are considered Europeans. They disappear more easily for visual reasons. They're viewed as less of a threat, and African or Middle Eastern migrants are simply much more political.
There's a lot of stigma.
I mean,
That's like a media narrative that they're viewed less of a threat.
Absolutely. I mean, they're simply constructed as a threat. But also, I mean, the difference is that in principle at least, the Ukrainians are given temporary protection, so the expectation is that they will want to go home. Refugees are permanent and are a permanent commitment, and that is politically a more difficult decision to make and brings more of a backlash. But there's no question that race, racism, Islamophobia play a role. It's not the entire role, that but it plays a role.
It's a media narrative.
It's a factor.
It's a media, because those like under 18, there's not going to be a threat to people under the age of 18 at the end.
Yeah.
And this goes into the Western perspective of border security. Et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, but it's also a numbers issue, because the question is, you know, if you have hundreds of thousands of children that you're going to transfer from Sudan to Europe, the sort of infrastructure you would need to cope with that is large. And the difference, of course, between Europe and the global south is you don't create massive refugee camps and tents and say, you go live there, and the UN will provide the humanitarian. You have to incorporate
them.
Exactly. Integrate them into existing structures,
mm-hmm.
and that's expensive,
yeah.
it's difficult. They're democracies, it creates backlash.
Yeah.
It is difficult.
Not to mention
dealing
with your own country's citizens and providing for them and making sure that all of that, you know, is being taken care of. There's a long narrative.
Absolutely.
Right?
And nothing creates more of a backlash than, you know, you imagine some family in Saxony that's having trouble getting a daycare spot, and then they see that the refugee gets one. Like, sometimes that's nonsense,
mm-hmm.
but if it does happen, that creates a huge factor.
A huge thing for your own citizens.
Yeah,
you know.
What is, like, a best structure for you if a country is going to receive, like, X amount of refugees, for example, like 500,000, 200,000?
A big question. A wealthy country, like...
Like a wealthy country, like Canada, for example, or Germany.
I mean,
both countries.
Angela Merkel said, "Wir schaffen das, we've got this," and they did. So the Germans invested sufficient resources into getting them into educational programs, into housing, into labor training, and not everything has gone well. But the sort of dire predictions of what would happen turned out absolutely wrong, and you're seeing. Certainly some Syrians rising up within the German occupational hierarchy. So if you extend the German answer, I mean, it's nothing brilliant I'm saying here. It's resources and political will. Unfortunately, that created a backlash, so it's not obvious that politically that can be done repeatedly. But yeah, that would be the short answer.
Yeah. It also depends on what side of the political spectrum the country taking them in is. Because I know Hungary... in Europe views it completely differently.
Yeah, it's
more
such
from
a
nationalistic, populistic view is that they, you know, their country, their people, they don't, you know, want, they're not as willing to take in certain refugees. So I think you need to have, you know, countries who have that humanitarian, that want to, have that pull.
Yeah, if the far right is in power, which
it
effectively is in Budapest, you will not have
it. You will not have it, right?
Yeah.
So it's hard to say that an EU, an integrated EU, will be the solution because the EU is also divided, you know, on two sides of the spectrum.
Yeah, but you're absolutely right. What you've seen in the discussions with the EU, though, is that they're countries like Germany and France are giving up on distributing resources across the EU, but there are moves to distributing resources. So if you take fewer... you pay for others who take more, and those resources go there. Again, as I said in our discussion with the Global South, the resources need to go where the refugees are.
Yeah.
But the refugee crisis will not be solved until we have political stability, above all, an absence of war in the major source countries. And
yeah.
There's no evidence of that. So I think the forced migration crisis is going to be with us for a very long time.
Sadly. Yeah, but we have countries like Canada, for example, where immigration is so popular.
So in your article, Why Both Left and Right Are Wrong, Immigration and Multiculturalism in Canada, you dissect the two main approaches to Canada's immigration policy, historically and policy-driven. Can you explain how these help inform and debate surrounding why immigration is so popular in Canada as compared to other countries, arguing that these are misinformed, you know, explanations? Can you briefly summarize your insights and comment on whether there have been any trends in recent years to further inform this perspective? To what extent have you seen Canada combat these rhetorical approaches to make them more easily, essentially, a policy?
Yeah, and the kind of question is, can the Canadian model be exported? I wrote that piece in reaction to a series of chiefly white male academics who go around the world as part of the Hallelujah Chorus. Canada gets everything right in immigration, and what the world needs to do to be a better place in matters of immigration is to become just a bit more Canadian. This is complete and utter nonsense, and this is why I wrote the piece. Why? One, Canada's exceptional in two respects. Complete control of its borders, water, ice, and the richest country in the world to our south. So to quote my colleague Jeff Wrights, America is a huge immigration wall that we made the Americans pay for. Two, this country selects high-skilled immigrants who very naturally integrate. And the third reason is more cultural. Multiculturalism in Canada is the solution to the eternal Canadian quest, not being American. Canadians have this quite delusional belief that the Americans are assimilationist, they're the melting pot, and Canadians are multicultural. It's actually total nonsense. If you look at attitudes among Canadians, they're highly assimilationist. Americans are more multicultural in the sense of a libertarian strain. The state can't tell me what to do, can't tell me I can't have my gun, it can't tell this group of immigrants how to live. Multiculturalism, though, since it's the basis of Canadian identity, i.e., not being American, means that immigration will always be popular. Because if you support multiculturalism, the basis of your identity,
mm-hmm.
how do you oppose immigration? It's a logical contradiction. So immigration is popular here, but not because Canadians are superior, but because borders are tight, high-skilled immigrants are selected, and it's the foundation of national identity. There's really nothing else.
Mm-hmm. I saw that an article came out with CBC talking about Canada's new migration policy. And they were looking to stabilize immigration levels at 500,000 per year in 2026. What are your thoughts on that?
Because especially housing prices are at an all-time high and housing shortages are on the rise. So how can Canada continue to support the citizens currently? And there's a lot of immigrants coming.
Yeah. I mean, I should preface it by saying I chiefly work on Europe. So I'm speaking more as a migration scholar rather than I don't work on Canada as such. That said, what was clear is that this was a political decision taken at the federal level without thinking through the implications for the provinces that have to cope with migration, above all Ontario and Toronto, and in the absence of massive investments in housing and in schools and in transportation, it won't work, and this is why the Canadians are, the federal government's kind of stepping back from that promise. There's a very odd element of the Canadian debate, this kind of drinking game with immigration, 300,000, 400,000, 500,000. These targets are arbitrary.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's a logic, an economic logic to them, it would be solving the productivity crisis. But after decades of very high levels of immigration, which I support, don't get me wrong,
mm-hmm.
productivity remains low. So whatever it is, it's not a solution to the productivity.
Yeah, I know that even in this summer in Toronto, there was a shortage of refugees housing. I think we all saw that on the news. There was downtown a bunch of shelters and refugee homes. There was a shortage of them, and a lot of them were being displaced on the streets for a while.
Yeah.
And I think that's a major factor that we need to consider is when we're taking in all of these refugees and immigrants, we need to make sure we have infrastructure in our city to support them.
Oh, absolutely. Otherwise, I mean, again, refugees are separate from the economic
yes.
migrants, but in both cases, particularly in the case of economic migrants, you can't sell them as bill of goods about the Canadian dream
mm-hmm.
without the infrastructure to support
there.
Them. Yeah. So again, all in favor of high levels of immigration, let the market pull migrants in, let them succeed,
mm-hmm.
but arbitrary targets of 400,000, 500,000, 600,000. This is not a way to govern a migration policy.
Yeah.
It's like a five-year plan in a communist country.
Like us. How do you govern like a migration policy then? Like how do you do it like a plan?
Well, again, I think it's a migration policy that's sensitive to the needs of the market, which will mean that any country with an aging population and a labor shortage will have high levels of migration, and that's a very good thing. A generous refugee policy is a separate
mm-hmm.
conversation. And then you need the investments to ensure that when migrants arrive, they have a place to live, schools to go to, decent hospitals. In a sense, it's not, you know, there's no rocket science to it, but it is expensive.
Yeah, because you said it's expensive then. Because you have in Europe, for example, which is a very wealthy country, you have the number of forcibly displaced and stateless people in Europe rose to 21.8 million people by the end of 2022, including almost 12.4 million refugees, 1.3 million asylum seekers, 7.2 million internally displaced people, and 474,000 who are stateless. What can the EU, Europe in general, do to solve this crisis as a wealthy state or like as a wealthy continent?
Yeah, and so the historical division of labor since 2001 is that the United States, through its wars, destabilizes the Middle East. Libya was the French and the British. That was slightly different. And then it leaves Europe, because of its geographical location, the task of picking up the pieces. So America takes way too few forced migrants, refugees, mm-hmm. given its role globally. Given its position, Europe will always be the destination point for massive numbers of migrants.
Yeah.
It needs to accept this fact, to view them as an opportunity, not a threat, and to use migrants, forced and voluntary, to solve what we know are very clear problems within European countries. Aging populations, massive labor shortages.
Yeah, because there was all the you were talking about like how it's like a base area where everyone goes to and they need to accept the fact. There were 159,000 sea arrivals in Italy, Greece, Spain, Cyprus, and Malta. 40% of those individuals that arrived to Europe by sea in 2019 were women and children, and there was 1,000 that died on the way. Can Europe find a way as well to facilitate the flow of immigration to those refugees until Europe, or are they going to keep on shutting down the borders for them?
Well, as it currently stands, they most certainly will, nominally to prevent deaths, but really for political reasons. What absolutely needs to be done is, again, I'll say it again, opening other channels. We have a situation in which forced migrants are drowning in the Mediterranean, are being sent back to torture camps in Libya, and when they make it to Rome, to Milan, to Vienna, to Berlin. They deliver our food, they work for Amazon, they wash dishes in the back of kitchens. There's a massive unrecognized low-skill labor shortage in Europe. Opening channels could solve that. That's the clear thing. There are other debates about offshore processing, which is to say processing refugee applications in North Africa, and when approved, bringing them to Europe without the need for crossing the Mediterranean or the Aegean. And that is, in principle, possible. The difficulty is those who want offshore processing at the moment, like the Danes and the British, they want to send the refugees to Rwanda so that they stay out of Europe entirely. So it can have an inclusive logic or an exclusionary logic, offshore processing. For the moment, it's just exclusionary.
Yeah. And do you think Brexit had some sort of impact on like the forcibly displaced and stateless people in Europe when they left the EU? Because the UK is known to be like a country that also attracts a lot of immigrants. So do you think that affected those policies as well?
It didn't have much of an effect on refugee flows, except that the French are less willing to cooperate in dealing with the boats crossing the channel. And the British brought that on themselves. The biggest effect of Brexit is in other forms of immigration. That the slogan was taking back control. And what we've seen is that Brexit created not less immigration, but more.
How come?
Much more. Because the UK has a structural dependence on cheap labor. It has the largest low-wage sector in any European economy. And the great thing about the EU is that free movement, internal EU migrants, fill that shortage. Poles working in plumbing or construction, Romanians in healthcare, and so on. When there was a British economic downturn, those migrants went back to the continent. Now, it's relatively easy, to the Brits' credit, to immigrate to the UK, but those migrants are not going home when they come from the subcontinent, South Asia, when they come from Africa. And so that's absolutely fine with me, but from the perspective of a Leaver who wanted Brexit to deliver immigration control, they got exactly the opposite. And this could have been predicted. I mean, it's one of the many disasters associated with the horror that is Brexit.
Yeah, that's very true. Now, I know you recently published your book about what I call the war works and wants, like the cause about immigration and the oil crisis in the Middle East. Can you tell us a bit more about your book?
Yeah, sure. The idea behind War, Work, and Want is to explain the great uptick in global migration, over 100 million unexpected migrants since 1973. And the argument is that it all came back to the oil crisis, which did two things, to oversimplify. First, it halved economic growth permanently in rich countries, and we rebuilt our standard of living on the back of cheap migrant labor, destroyed the unions, debased wages, and when domestic workers exited meatpacking, agriculture, retail, and other sectors, construction, migrants were brought in the tens of millions. The flood of oil money with the Gulf states, the Middle East, destabilized them, led to war, revolution, and tens of millions of forced migrants. So war, work, and want, the consumer's desire for ever cheaper products, this drives global migration flows.
So this oil crisis, countries like Europe benefited from it, but like the Middle Eastern countries?
No. Europe and North America didn't benefit. It hurt them very badly because growth, which had been 5% a year or 6% a year, halved and never returned. We thought the Middle East benefited, and they did in purely monetary terms, a massive flood of money. But this is discussed in the literature as the oil curse. It initiated other processes, created other problems that rebounded on them.
Yeah. And we see oil is always like the major topic, not the major topic, but one of the central factors when, you know, there's war. We saw the U.S. trying to make deals, you know, with other Middle Eastern countries when there was the war with Russia and Ukraine, because Russia is obviously a big supply, you know, of oil. So I feel like that's, you know, a main factor within war and oil crisis, and it's like, which country are we going to deal with next? What's going to supply this? And it also, you know, correlates to countries' economy internally with inflation, prices, et cetera, et cetera.
I know. I mean, really, in two senses. One, resources that lead you to go to war.
Mm-hmm.
The two Gulf Wars, the Americans went in partly, though not only, to assure the steady supply of oil to the United States. The Soviets invaded Afghanistan so they can continue stealing Afghan natural gas in 1979. And in the case of Putin, energy is a weapon of war,
mm-hmm.
trying to freeze the Germans and destroy their economy in order to enable their illegal annexation of Ukraine.
For Putin, it wasn't the first time for a leader to use energy as a weapon of war. Like, because Iraq used it as well in the war, like previously in the 90s. Do you remember that?
Yeah, well, I mean, Iraq invaded Kuwait in 1990 in order to secure a monopoly over Kuwait's oil supplies and to control the world price. And that was exactly why the Americans put together a coalition to stop Saddam Hussein. Yeah, it was all about oil. Yeah.
Well, thank you again, Dr. Hansen, for taking the time today to discuss these very prevalent topics. To our listeners, if you have any questions, please feel free to email us. And stay tuned for our next episode soon, and we will speak to you the next time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.